The views and opinions expressed by callers, guests, and hosts do not necessarily reflect those of the Black Talk Radio Network and Black Talk Media Project. Black Talk Radio is new black media for the new millennium. Good evening. You are tuned in to BTR News. My name is Scotty Reed. I'm broadcasting from behind the enemy lines of USA Inc. It is a Tuesday night here on Black Talk Radio Network. It is December the 5th, 2017. My firstborn will be celebrating a birthday here in just a couple of days. So happy birthday to my firstborn. You know who you are. Good to be back on these airways after a week, which again, this is our new broadcast time for Black Talk Radio News. It will be at 8 o'clock p.m. Eastern on Tuesday nights, and tonight we'll be on for a couple of hours as we have a couple of guests scheduled for you. We will be joined at the half-hour mark in this first hour by Sophia of the campaign to bring Momia home in New York City. Of course, we're talking about political prisoner, Black Panther Party member, outstanding journalist, even from behind prison walls, he's still putting in work. But we're talking about Momia Abu-Jamal, who is enslaved in Pennsylvania and has been for quite some time after he was framed for the killing of a slave catcher who actually had pistol whipped his brother. So we will hear from her tonight about a couple of events that's coming up in Pennsylvania, primarily, or I should say specifically in Philadelphia, two events that are happening related to Momia Abu-Jamal. There will be a teach-in for Momia. Have Black Lives Ever Mattered is the title that'll be occurring on December the 8th of this month. And that will be at the Church, the Advocate, or Church of the Advocate, 1801 West Diamond Street in Philadelphia for our Black Talk Radio listeners in the Philadelphia area. The second event will also be in Philly. That will be December the 9th, 2017. And there will be a march and rally in support of Momia Abu-Jamal. There will also be a forum on quote-unquote mass incarceration, but of course we know on this network that it's not mass incarceration, it's slavery. It's that simple. So now the nation continues to focus on sexual harassment, assault, rape, and most of the coverage has been focused on the victims as privileged white women who are being preyed upon by powerful white men for the most part. I know John Conyers just retired after reports of inappropriate behavior on his part. So he retired today. So there have been some black faces involved in this. We did hear from Terry Crews, who was assaulted by a powerful white male. But here's the side of the conversation that's missing. What about the sexual misdeeds against men, and particularly black men in the workplace, which I have been a victim of? I mean, the other day, or it was last week when I first decided that, hey, I want to talk about this, because they're, you know, not to dismiss sexual assault against anyone, And that's my point, is that this conversation needs to be more inclusive. If we're going to talk about sexual harassment, sexual assault, if we're going to talk about rape, why should we be leaving anybody out the conversation? Why should only one segment of the population be portrayed as victims and another segment being painted as the sole perpetrators, when that is not the case? Sexual harassment, assault, rape crosses gender lines. It crosses class lines. It crosses racial lines. It crosses religious lines. So I'm starting to believe, based off of this, I don't know how long this conversation has been going on, in a much needed conversation, but it seems to me it has been politicized by feminists. Okay, who want all the sympathy in the world, but at the same time, they don't want to address the sexual predators in their midst. And I'm talking about women. So as I was thinking about this segment for Black Talk Radio News, I just not getting a piece of paper or anything, writing it down, but I was able to recall at least 5 or 6 incidents where I was sexually assaulted on the job, sexually harassed on the job. Some of it occurred when I was in the military. Some of it occurred in the civilian sector. The first time I could recall it happening to me, I was 18 years old, working in a Wendy's fast food restaurant. Had not even thought about joining the military at that time, but I was working 2 jobs. I was staying, me and a girlfriend was cohabitating, and I was working 2 jobs, and that was the first job that I would say I was sexually assaulted on that job by my white manager, okay, and all the sexual inappropriate comments her and another white woman who was her assistant manager used to make on the job, and I was subjected to these comments and what have you. So we don't want to minimize this very serious issue, but at the same time, I'm not going to allow people to minimize the victimization of males. So joining us during the second hour of tonight's broadcast, we will speak with Dr. Tommy J. Curry. He is the author of The Man Not, Race, Class, Genre, and the Dilemmas of Black Manhood. And we're going to hope that he can help us make some sense of all of this. So that's what's on tap for you tonight. Again, we will be talking to Sister Sophia at the half hour mark, and we'll get some information concerning Mumia Abu-Jamal, get an update on him. I do know that he did get treatment. He won his case in court to get access to the hepatitis C medical treatment, which can cure hepatitis C. And a lot of people don't know that hepatitis C is I would call it a pandemic in the prison system. And that, I mean, it's just real widespread, but yet they deny these people the medicine that is available that can cure it. They, you know, it's like they don't care, because they don't. These are slaves, man. Why should we give a damn about these slaves? It's the attitude that these municipalities, these state governments, and the federal government seem to be taking. Why would you want diseases to be spread within the prison plantation system when there's a cure for this? And then these people get out, and guess what they do? They end up spreading it to the community. So that's a very serious issue. But I know Mumia Abu-Jamal, after a long campaign, did get access to that treatment. And that disease can cause a lot of problems for people. Very, very terrible disease. So that's what's on tap for tonight. I do have some news that I want to share with you, some what I call news of the day, that we'll take a listen to, or you will listen to me share some of the information with you. But let me first go ahead and give out the telephone numbers. The telephone numbers, if you would like to get involved in the conversation, if you would like to ask a question, you can call us at 866-510-9025. That's 866-510-9025. You hit star to put yourself in the caller's queue. I will recognize you and bring you on air. Also, please continue to support the work of the Black Talk Media Project, which is a U.S.-based nonprofit. It is, along with the Black Talk Radio Network, which is managed by the Black Talk Media Project, entering into its 10th year of existence. It's hard to believe, man. These 10 years went by real fast, man. If Black Talk Radio Network and Black Talk Media Project was a child, you know, they would be in elementary school right now, I guess. But it's been a wonderful 10 years. Wish that we were able to do more, but because we don't go after financial support from the U.S. government or many of these corporations and these nonprofits that give out money for public media, you know, it's just been a long, hard road, but a long, hard road that needed to be plowed nonetheless. And so just want to be thankful for all those who have helped us plow the way, because Black media, especially independent Black media, I'm not talking about Black faces on TV or Black faces working at these corporate news outlets. I'm talking about truly independent Black media, where the publisher is a Black person, the editor is a Black person, the writers are Black people, and they're focused on Black life and how the world relates to that Black life, which we know it doesn't matter to the world, but it is up to us to make our lives matter. We can't be sitting around waiting on somebody else to acknowledge our lives matter. We have to make our lives matter. Okay, that's how I feel about it. But we do want to thank those who have supported us over the years. We are having our 9th anniversary fundraiser, trying to raise a budget for 2018. Last year, we only raised about $6,000. It helped pay some bills. We had another fundraiser to get New Abolitionist Radio, including myself, and Max Parthas and a couple of other abolitionists to the Washington, D.C. Millions for Prisoners for Human Rights. We were able to sponsor the PA sound system and what have you. So, you know, I just want to thank those who gave and those who continue to give. Remember, another way that you can support our work is by joining the BTRCommunity.com social media platform. $24 for life. I know it says $24 a year, but we're not kicking anybody out. I just don't think that we should only include people based on their ability to pay. All right, because we're a nonprofit. We're not in this for profit, but it do take money for us to run everything that we're running, and that's one of the ways we try to raise some funds, is through offering subscriptions to our social media community, which you can find at btrcommunity.com or go to community.blacktalkradionetwork.com. So let's get into some of this news of the day. Oh man, I almost opened up something that I did not mean to open up, some software. Once it loads up, I just had to X out of it. But let me pull up this video. Now, Zimbabwe, I did a program maybe last week, a couple of weeks ago. Yeah, a couple of weeks ago. I kind of did an in-depth program focusing on Zimbabwe after the military intervention led to the removal of Robert Mugabe. And one of the things that I learned researching that is that even once Zimbabwe gained its independence, I can't answer the question why, because I wasn't there. I wasn't in on the conversation or anything like that. I did not have a vote. I'm not a Zimbabwean, so, you know, obviously. But in the 1980s, I think I was what, in high school, middle school in the 1980s. The government, the Zimbabwe government, entered into a predatory loan with the IMF and the World Bank. And if you've never seen the documentary Confessions of an Economic Hitman, and how these institutions use money, lending money, predatory loans to keep their grip on countries, then you need to check that out. Again, that's called Confessions of an Economic Hitman. And so I had learned that their new government back in the 80s got into these predatory loans. And I was like, man, why would you do that? Why would you? I mean, don't you know the devil when you see him? You just got your independence from these people. Why would you enter into a loan agreement with them? You know, again, I wasn't there. I don't know what their immediate needs were and what have you. I just know, based off of history of the IMF, is that they're not to be trusted. And so I'm going to let you hear this report, which is coming to you from CGTN Africa. It's an African-based news outlet, and you can find them on YouTube. But it says the IMF has pledged financial support to Zimbabwe as part of efforts to restore its ailing economy. So let's go ahead and listen to this short report. Again, this is from CGTN Africa, which is an African-based news outlet.
The IMF has pledged financial support to Zimbabwe as part of efforts to restore its ailing economy. The country's economy, described as one of the most fragile in the world, has been dominated by cash liquidity problems, dollar shortages, a crumbling infrastructure, and crippled utility service supplies. IMF experts are expected in Harare this week and should meet the new cabinet. But new money can't be provided until several preconditions are met, including resolving arrears of roughly $2 billion to the World Bank, Africa Development Bank, and the European Investment Bank.
We stand ready to support the authorities in their efforts to design policies that can indeed restore stability and growth. And moreover, in addition to a strong and coherent reform program, we see a concerted international effort will be required to revive and reintegrate the Zimbabwean economy. An IMF financial arrangement, for example, would only be possible after progress in resolving Zimbabwe's arrears to other international financial institutions and other creditors.
Now, here's the thing. If somebody already owed $2 billion and they behind in their payments, why would you offer them or extend to them another loan? Now, we know it don't work that way in the real world. If I had a whole bunch of loans and I'm always late paying those loans and I'm saddled with all this debt, what do you think the chances are I can go to another bank and get some money and get a loan? They're going to look at my credit history. They're going to look at my status on my current loans. They're going to look at what I can, what my assets are, and if I can cover these loans and what have you. So again, it doesn't even make sense for the IMF and World Bank to be extending possible loans to Zimbabwe when they already $2 billion in debt. Already are in default of the loans that they got in the 1980s. So it must be some other reason that the IMF and the World Bank is ready to dump billions, possibly a trillion more dollars in loans to Zimbabwe. And that's not a good thing. And I hope they don't. I hope they got enough good sense not to repeat the same mistake over as they made in the 1980s. Again, this is the 1980s. That's what? That's over 40 years ago. And you still $2 billion in debt? Yeah, you were a victim of predatory lending and you want to get money from these same predators? It doesn't make sense, people, and let's hope that they don't do it. Zimbabwe is rich in natural resources. I had read that another article in the recent weeks that they were going to start backing their currency with gold and diamonds because they got a lot of diamond mines in Zimbabwe. And considering their new relationship with China, and China has been investing in the infrastructure of the country, it doesn't make any sense for them to get into the bed again with people that they know are predators. It don't make sense. The IMF, World Bank, run from them. Run. You should be running in the opposite direction. Okay? So they making it known, hey, we got this money over here if y'all want to come get it. You want to sell your soul, you want to sell your people out, we got it. We got what you need. Okay? It makes absolutely no sense. And remember, I reported an article that was published in the Washington, D.C. based publication called The Hill, where you had this business consultant who works as a Washington, D.C. lobbyist write an open letter to Donald Trump and basically tell Donald Trump to do the same thing. Hey, let's not worry about any kind of long, short-term stability or violence or anything like that. Let's see if we can get him some money so that we can get our foot in the door, basically, and put them under our boot. This woman openly stated this in her article that was published as an open letter to Donald Trump, and it was published in The Hill. So I thought that was pretty interesting that even though Zimbabwe is already $2 billion in debt, probably never be able to pay that off. Who knows what the interest rate is, but already $2 billion in debt, and you're going to take on and you're going to offer them more money? Really, what's your real end play here? Again, I will point you to the documentary. You can pull it up on YouTube. I forget the guy's name who confessed to being one of these World Bank IMF hitmen. The Confessions of an Economic Hitman. Just look that up. You'll be able to find the documentary in full. I think his name was John Perkins, if I'm not mistaken. And he first put that out in a book. It was in a book, but now it's been turned into a documentary. So IMF experts are expected in Harare, which is the Zimbabwean capital, this week, and should meet with the new cabinet. But again, I would urge that cabinet, if they would take my advice, if I don't know how much my advice is worth, but to not even let these people in your country. You have natural resources. I understand you're in all this debt and you need some help. But I would rather turn the help to either other African nations or your current partner, the Chinese. But one thing is for sure is that people, we need to start reading the fine print on these loans, man. How many times are they going to get us with these predatory loans, because we don't read the fine print? We just want them to show us the money. Show us the money. Then show me where to sign. And then next thing you know, we're being cheated. And it's too late to complain then. So that is a story that concerns the African diaspora and our brothers and sisters in Africa. And I just hope that they learn the lesson from the 1980s that you do not take loans from the IMF or the World Bank. You could do without. You've been doing without all this time. You can do without and slowly build your stuff up by selling off some of your resources or however, you know, and instead of putting your children's children's children in a debt to these people. Just don't do it, man. Don't do it. All right. Next story. FCC refused to include 50,000 net neutrality complaints in the repeal docket. So you may have been hearing, may not have been hearing about net neutrality. Net neutrality, again, let me give you out a brief description of what net neutrality is. Net neutrality is when all internet service providers, whether we're talking about Comcast, AT&T, Time Warner, whoever you with, all right, that could also be Verizon, as they, I don't know if they offer in-home internet service, but I do know, you know, you can get it through your smartphones with Verizon. Most of these cell phone carriers or smartphone carriers have, you know, internet plans and data plans where you, you know, can browse the internet. So what the net neutrality rules did was make these ISP providers treat all traffic equally, meaning that you couldn't speed up the loading of one website when one of your subscribers, one of your customers wants to visit, let's say, YouTube, and YouTube loads up really fast on your network. But then let's say they want to go check out some videos on Vimeo, and Vimeo is taking 5 minutes to load because whatever ISP provider I'm on has slowed down Vimeo's network on their services. So net neutrality means you got to treat all traffic equally. You can't speed up people's stuff, you can't slow people's stuff down. It's known in the industry as throttling, you know, throttling down. You either throttle up the traffic, make it go faster, or throttle it down, meaning make it go slower. So that's what that's about. And, you know, the FCC is in Republican hands right now under Ajit Pai, I believe is his name, who is the commissioner now, a former attorney working for Verizon, for the media corporations. And so this is the article that comes to you from, what is, how you pronounce this? ARSTechnica.com, ARSTechnica.com. And they're reporting that 50,000 net neutrality complaints. Now, these are people complaining that the whatever ISP provider was throttling traffic to their websites or businesses. So let me share a little bit with you before we bring on our guest, Sister Sophia, with the Bring Momia Home campaign out of NYC. The federal communications docket for its repeal of net neutrality rules is missing something. More than 50,000 complaints that internet customers have filed against their ISPs since the rules took effect in 2015. The National Hispanic Media Coalition was able to obtain the text of net neutrality complaints from the FCC via a public records request, but says it has not been able to convince the FCC to include them in the repeal docket. It seems to me that the commission is going to great lengths to ignore these documents and not incorporate them into the record. The National Hispanic Media Coalition General Counsel Karma Scurado told ARS. This is the latest dispute between the National Hispanic Media Coalition and the FCC over net neutrality complaints. The NHMC filed a Freedom of Information Act request in May for complaints that internet users filed against their ISPs and their ISPs' responses to those complaints. All right, so why is the National Hispanic Media Coalition interested in this? Because the Hispanics have their own media that they put out. Actually, the Hispanic-based company, well, I shouldn't say Hispanic-based company, but what is the name of that company? I can't think of its name. Its name just slipped me. But it actually owns some media platforms that target black people. I forget the name of it. But yeah, Hispanics have a huge stake in media. Them, along with black people, are the fastest growing consumers of digital media. As you know, I recall the report that I shared with you all some weeks back and what have you. So they have a vested interest in making sure that their media platforms and stuff are not held hostage and what have you. So I think that's very important story. There are a number of net neutrality petitions out there that you can sign in support of net neutrality. All you got to do is Google net neutrality petition and you'll find a whole bunch of them. I've signed as many as I've come across. I've signed those. Will it do any good? I can't say. You know, it only took me less than a minute to sign, digitally sign each one. So it's not like, you know, I invested a whole bunch of time and lost a whole bunch of time signing a petition. But who knows? Will it guarantee that they won't do it or kill net neutrality rules? No, there's no guarantees in life, period. But I guarantee you that they will kill them if they don't hear from the public. I can guarantee you that. Again, you can have a public outrage. You can have every single person in the United States say they want net neutrality, but that's still not going to be a guarantee. So I'm just trying to keep it real with people. I don't know what's going to happen. I hope the net neutrality rules stay in place. If they don't, we'll have to deal with it. As Black Talk Media Project, we'll have to deal with it as best it can with our media property. So, you know, that is something that I thought was newsworthy. All right. So let me go ahead and pull up this phone number so I can bring in Sophia to discuss this upcoming events happening in Philly on the behalf of Momia Abu-Jamal. So y'all just bear with me as I get her number in here. All right. So hopefully she'll be joining us in the next couple of minutes. So while we do that, let's take a quick station identification break. You're listening to Black Talk Radio News on the Black Talk Radio Network.
You are tuned in to the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasts and live program scheduling, visit us on the web at blacktalkradionetwork.com.
All right. And welcome back. Again, this is Black Talk Radio News. Today's date is December the 5th, 2017. And I'm not sure if that was Sophia who just joined us on the line. If that is you, please hit ** to unmute yourself so we can get this update from you. What's going on with our dear brother, our elder now, Momia Abu-Jamal. All right, doesn't look like that's her. So let me just pull up some information. Let's see. We got somebody on the board. I don't want to say a name, but is this our guest, Sophia?
Yes, this is she.
All right. Well, welcome to Black Talk Radio News. Thank you for joining us tonight.
Thank you for having me.
Oh, you're most certainly welcome. So, you are with the campaign. What's the name of it? Campaign to Free Momia out of NYC?
Yes, that's the campaign to bring Momia home.
The campaign to bring Momia home out of NYC.
That's correct.
All right. So before we get into the details of these events that's coming up, can you share any updates in terms of Momia himself, that you may have heard at the beginning of the program? I mentioned the fact that he did win his lawsuit to get access to hepatitis C medication. Do you know how he's doing in terms of his health or anything else personally going on with him that you would like to share?
Yes. So thank you again for having me on your show. I'm in the midst of this crazy rain, so I hope my background did not pick that up. So, Momia has been doing okay health-wise. He did receive the medication for his Hep C condition, and he is currently doing fine in that department. I can almost say I believe he's Hep C cured. However, he is still dealing with the constant itching over his body, and that's really where things are with him, that's still an issue, an outstanding issue for him, mm-hmm. as of late. And I even had the opportunity to visit with him about 2 weeks ago, my second visit with him in about a month, 2 weeks ago. And he sounds well, he's extremely sharp, and he is doing well overall with all that he has going on. But it cannot be neglected to say that his skin condition is still an issue. And as far as I know right now, he doesn't have a specialist that is seeing him on that. So hopefully that's something in the works for him very soon.
Hopefully. And if it's anything that the public can do to help, please let us know. So he can get the medical care that he needs. Now, I have another question. I know that Philadelphia recently elected a district attorney that's being described as a progressive, who's being, you know, described as the opposite of what they have had in Seth Williams up there, the recently disgraced Seth Williams, who may be going to jail soon. And then his mentor, I forget that lady's name, but that she was described as the deadliest DA in the United States. Yes, Ms. Abraham. Yes. So I do know that Mamiya in the past has filed appeals to try to get a new trial. So is there anything that you can make us aware of in terms of a new strategy, being that we have this quote unquote, and these are their words, not mine, this progressive DA?
Yes. So we are still, you know, in that process of having Mumia win a new trial. We are still in the process of having the DA's office do what's expected of them, what has been asked of them by the judge, to hand over all the files, and that's ongoing. With this election of DA-elect Krasner, I know that we hope to have some kind of a talk, some kind of a conversation with him in the near future, but nothing at the moment that I can say with him being elected, nothing at the moment that seems concrete enough to point us in the right direction of what's next regarding how he will approach a case like Mumia's, but even the many others like Mumia's, Move, and the other political prisoners,
right,
and people wrongfully convicted in Philadelphia. Nothing of that sort has been addressed, I think, by him. I know in the past we, as a movement, we have approached him to speak on it, and because he was in the process of campaigning, he could not go into any kind of details, but he did essentially say, or gave us the kind of assurance that he intends to do what's right and following along with his usual progressive agenda. I also know that we're still, you know, back and forth in terms of the court and the DA's office, and so that's still up in the air. But I believe at some point in January, if I'm not mistaken, there will be there was an order made by the judge towards the DA's office. So that's another update that exists, but I'm not 100% clear on all the details behind that. And
I understand.
So I don't want to give all that out right now until
I understand. But certainly, you know, whether or not he continues to comply with the judge's order to turn over all those records, I mean, I think that that will give us an inkling of what kind of DA he might be, you know, because in the past, you know, Seth Williams definitely tried everything he could do to obstruct justice in Mumia's case. So we'll find out shortly, you know, what this new DA is about. So, but thank you for I'm sorry, go ahead.
Just quickly, along the lines of that, I'm not sure if your listeners know, but we are having two big, big days of events this Friday and Saturday in Philadelphia.
Yes, that's what I wanted to go into. If you could share First, let's talk about the teach-in for Mumia, Have Black Lives Ever Mattered, which will be occurring on December the 8th at the Church of the Advocate. That's 1801 West Diamond Street in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. What can you tell us about this?
Yeah, so there will be a teach-in on December the 8th, as you have said, that starts at 6 p.m. at the Church of the Advocate, and there will be a number of panelists on different topic areas of those teachings, and there will be, I believe, about four or five categorical areas around what's the latest with Mumia, legally, health-wise, mass incarceration, school-to-prison pipeline, and I believe another one is around immigration and possibly one with Trump intertwined in there somehow. So those are the key parts of Friday's event, the teachings that will be taking place in Philadelphia.
And that's this Friday, okay? Now the second event, which will also be in Philly, which will be the very next day, December the 9th, will be a march and rally in support of Mumia, but also a forum on quote-unquote mass incarceration. What can you tell us about that?
Yeah, so that will be a huge day as well, starting early in the morning at 11, actually around the Rizzo statue, the statue that's about to be removed, actually. So that the march will start at around 11 or 11:30 or so, and after the march, the march will be going into City Hall, and after that, there will be a 2 p.m. event, larger event, I believe more cultural, that will take place at the Arch Street Church, I believe it's called.
Yeah, let me pull up the details on that for the listeners, for those that... Give me a second. I had to go to my broadcast page. Give me just a second. I have linked for those that's listening now or will listen to the podcast. I have linked to both of the events, which are posted on Facebook. If you're a member of btrcommunity.com, this network's social media community, I believe Tag has posted this information in our event section as well. Let me see. It says...
And I just found it in myself.
Oh, okay. Well, you go ahead. You go ahead and tell us. Yes.
Yeah. My apologies. I just happened to bring it up back. So, yes, that will be a forum. It will be a march starting at about 11. And there will be a forum at about 2 p.m. at United Methodist Church at Arch Street, by Arch Street. And essentially, again, there will be a cultural kind of atmosphere there. And, you know, we definitely want to have discussions and having people be able to, new people come into the work and see what's happening and being fed this information, but being aware that there's something more they can do, especially in this new age of number 45. So I really think it's important that people attend both days, but just having that cultural aspect of it on Saturday is just even another element for the younger folks who, you know, essentially will take up this baton of leading our society into a better world.
I most certainly agree. And I have a lot of faith in the younger generation that's coming up behind us, like Tag, who helped set this interview up with you, and all the young people that I witnessed in Washington, D.C. back in August for the Millions for Prisoners Human Rights March. So I'm just very hopeful for the future, but I'm also hopeful that, hey, we will resolve these issues before I'm dead and gone.
Agreed.
All right. Well, I want to thank you again, Sophia. Is there anything else that you would like to share with our audience as we conclude this segment?
not on this segment. I know we have our big event next week in New York City, so I'm ready to talk about that as well.
Okay, well, when is it next week?
So, yes, that's next week, Wednesday, December 13th, from 7 to 10 p.m. And that's in Harlem at a space called Raw Space.
And this will be for Mumia?
Yes, so this is essentially a book party that we have. So, for those who may not know, Mumia has a new release for a few months now, and it's called Have Black Lives Ever Mattered? And so we've been planning for some time now a celebratory event to celebrate the fact that we have a book like this in our hands, but the meaning behind this book, the purpose behind this book, and how we can take that out of the smaller circles and bring it to a larger audience of people. That Mumia is essentially curating his own book party, and he's been in discussions with us for some time now on how he wants this to look like, what's the purpose of this, and where he sees this going essentially after having this party. So we have an amazing, amazing lineup of speakers and a performance by Emotional Technique, a special performance that is, and hopefully a special call-in by Mumia. Again, Mumia curated this, his book party. He gave us ideas on the kind of music he would like to have there, on the kind of his favorite drinks, and food. So that's really interesting to just have him be a part of this and have people feel like his spirit is so in there and so embodied within a kind of event that we're putting on for his book release, and really getting a conversation going around this amazing book. And again, that's called Have Black Lives Ever Mattered?
Have Black Lives Ever Matter, and that's going down Wednesday. If you would, well, I'm sure Tag has that information. He's based there in NYC like you are, and I'm sure he will be sending me that information and posting it to BTR community. And I will remember to bring it up on my next Tuesday night broadcast the day before.
Yes, that'll be amazing. We definitely need that house packed, and we know it will be packed, so it's great to just have all areas of promotion happening. So thank you for that.
Well,
we want people to revel, drink, and just be merry as we celebrate this moment.
Well, thank you, Sophia, for everything that you're doing on behalf of Mumia and all our political prisoners and prisoners of war, and what you're doing for the community, because I feel that when we are advocating for our political prisoners, we're actually advocating for ourselves. So I want to thank you for that work. And we also will go ahead and close this out, and I will say, stay safe behind these enemy lines of USA Inc. You have a good night.
Thank you. Thank you. You have a great night, and thank you for having me.
You're welcome. All right. That was Sister Sophia bringing us some information in relation to our brother, our elder brother, Mumia Abu-Jamal. Again, let me just quickly give out that information again about the two events. The teach-in for Mumia, Have Black Lives Ever Mattered, will be on December the 8th. That's this Friday at the Church of the Advocate, 1801 West Diamond Head Street, Philadelphia. The second event will also be in Philly on December the 9th, the March and the Rally. Again, I have linked to these events, which are posted on Facebook in my program description for tonight, as well as I believe Tag has posted those to BTR community. Yes, I'm looking at it now. Yes, he did post it to BTR community. Have Black Lives Ever Matter book party is the one that I'm looking at right now that she just spoke of that's going down next Wednesday. All right, listen, I need to take a station identification break. We're going to kick some music. Tonight I'm featuring the hip-hop group Run DMC. So we'll be playing a couple of tracks throughout the broadcast. Univision. Yes, Otis. Thank you, Otis. Otis in the chat room said Univision. That's the name of that Hispanic-owned company that I was trying to think of. Univision. And I think it's the Griot that they own. It's the Griot or the Root. I think it's the Root that they own. So, yeah, thank you for that, Otis. That's correct. I was trying to think of Univision. All right, so you're listening to Black Talk Radio. News on the Black Talk Radio Network, airing every Tuesday night live, beginning at 8 o'clock p.m. Eastern time. So happy that you could join us tonight. During the second hour, at the top of the hour, we'll be talking to Dr. Tommy J. Curry. I want to discuss the flip side of the sexual harassment conversation that is going on nationally. I want it to be more inclusive. I mean, just today, I read another story about another teacher seducing another young high school boy, okay? And so sexual harassment, sexual assault is wrong no matter who does it, all right? But at the same time, it seems to me that that there is a political agenda underfoot as it pertains to this, because it's not an all-inclusive conversation. It seems to be what I might call a gender war in pertaining to blaming all one gender for all our problems, or being the primary predators when, again, especially we're going to be talking about this in the Black community. How can we leave out the historic sexual assault of the Black family? Not just Black women, not just Black men, but even Black children, all right? There is his history behind this, and it continues to this day, again, as I stated. You know, I remember being sexually assaulted on a job when I was just 18 years old, working for Wendy's, when my white manager came up behind me and got a palm full of booty and then laughed and walked away. All right, that was sexual assault. I felt very uncomfortable. I didn't welcome that advance. I didn't invite that advance. So I understand totally how these women feel, because this happened to me. And before somebody, you know, say, well, you know, you just don't care about women or anything like that. I mentioned to somebody else I was having a conversation with, I lost a job behind me giving testimony in a lawsuit of a Black woman against the vice president of the company I was working for. They didn't fire me right away, but it was shortly after I gave that testimony on her behalf that I lost that job. Now, she had my phone number to give to her attorney to take my deposition over the phone, but after she settled her case, did I get a phone call thanking me, saying, thank you, Scotty. You know, you didn't have to do that. You didn't have to stick your neck out for me. You could have been like so many other people and just looked the other way and been concerned about yourself and how many butter biscuits you can get on your plate. And I never heard from her. Now, I'm not holding that against her. I didn't do it because of her being a Black woman. I did it because it was the right thing to do. I mean, I just basically, like I told my mom, I just basically told the truth. They asked me some questions. I told the truth. So, but I'm just tired of people making Black men out to be the predators when this society has been preying upon us ever since this nation was created. So we'll be talking to Dr. Tommy J. Curry to discuss the flip side of the sexual harassment, sexual assault conversation that's happening. If you would like to join with any questions or comments of your own, you can give us a call at 866-510-9639. 866-510-9025. That's 866-510-9025. You'll hit ** to put yourself in the caller's queue. Like I said, at this time, we're going to take a music break, and tonight we are featuring the artist Run DMC.
Recruiting suckers, Mac and Mike, and making men of them. Tears and fears for my peers, they risen. You think that it is, if not it isn't. Race for the border, my daughter could beat her banging out. Chiefs rocking beats in the streets, and it's time for hanging out. Gather or rather for my circle around out loud. Yeah, cause brothers or others could never ever rock a crowd. Is it because he's running off with the mouth? Or was he really clearly trying to play a out? Nope, shut him down, the king with the crown. Cause all you wanna be is Dickie Down. A friend of mine asked me to say some MC rhyme, so I said this rhyme I'm about to say. The rhyme was Mecca, and then it went this way. Recollect a Mecca, mic check on a windmill skill. Mac the stacks wearing Godfather hats. It's okay to parlay the forte better. Tell him tougher than leather. Swing another Rodney King thing and I wreck. But just like the white one, I get no respect. Money stay away, cause the other fake. From Hollis to the Beacon, know your dumb ass is leaking. CL and Run DMC, so rush it. Big time wave before Hammer got to touch it. Remember the faces in all types of places. Look, ma, no shoelaces. And I'm
you wanna be? You wanna be? You wanna be? Check it. I'm taking the tours, I'm wrecking the land. I keep it hardcore cause it's dope, man. These are the roughest, toughest words I ever wrote, damn. Not meant for a hole like a slow jam. Check it. Sucker MCs could never swing with D because of all the things that I bring with me. Only G.O.D. could be a king to me. And if the G.O.D. be in me, then a king I be. The microphone is granted when it's handed to me. I was planted on this planet and I plan to MC. The MC fiends only seem to agree that I rock the world. Society. I rage on the stages with a tuna verse. I give praises from these stages to the universe. My voice is raw, my lyrics is law. I keep it hardcore like you never saw. You wanna be, you wanna be, you know you wanna be. You wanna be, you wanna be, wanna be. You know you wanna be.
To be. I went to John Jay University, and since kindergarten I acquired the knowledge, and after 12th grade I went straight to college. Down with the kings on the mic, a full swinger, the P to the R, not an R&B singer, the R to the UNDMC, and the fly human beings, tonight I hold the key. Flown with the funk track, hear the soul brother Black, pick up the bass, better yet leave the space. So let me put my big black Twinkie on into the early morning, had the skins yawning. Mecca, yo, you want the Mecca, yo, I make a funky beat so we can blow, check it out. He rocks the boot knock, put you in a headlock, and now all the yada yada flock, cause I'm down with the kings.
Peter,
Piper,
pick peppers,
but Run Rock,
rhyme,
Humpty,
Dumpty,
fell
down,
that's his heart,
time,
Jackie,
nimble,
what,
nimble,
and he was
quick,
my jam,
mass
mud,
faster jacks on Jay's dick.
My little Bo Peep Cole lost her sheep, and Rip Van Winkle fell a hella sleep, and out of chill and summer in Wonderland, Jack serving Jill bucket in his hand, and damn, that's a game, making out that sound, the turntables might wobble, but they don't fall down.
Yeah.
Black Talk Radio since 2008, providing new black media for the masses. And welcome back to Black Talk Radio News. We are live tonight. It is December the 5th, 2017, on this Tuesday night. And we should be joined here shortly by Dr. Tommy J. Curry. And let me just pull up this information from his book, The Man Not. All right. So, The Man Not, Race, Class, Genre, and the Dilemmas of Black Manhood. And here is a foreword that was written about the book by Ishmael Reed, Professor Emeritus at the University of California, Berkeley, and visiting scholar at the California College of the Arts. Tommy Curry has written a cool, brilliant defense of the men who are the pariahs of American society, the ones who, regardless of class, find themselves at the bottom of every hierarchy, the ones whose demographics and statistics in terms of the criminal justice, healthcare, and other systems are abysmal. Countless billions have been made from the portrayal of black males as boogeymen. The Man Not is heavy work, but the general reader will find its arguments well worth the time and effort. This book is controversial. Those who've dogged and stalked black men in academia and popular culture for the past few decades are sure to have their critical knives out. I know, but it's rare for an American intellectual to step up regardless of the fallout. This book is the one that I've been waiting for. Curry has taken a bullet for the brothers. All right, so definitely looking forward to speaking to Dr. Curry, who I do believe we have on the line with us. Dr. Curry, do we have you, sir?
Yes, sir, you do. How are you doing?
I'm doing the best I can behind these enemy lines, and I'm just going to be real about that. Hey, I'm doing the best I can. I don't like to complain too much because there are so many others out there doing worse than me. So that's what this platform is about, to raise those very serious issues, which you do in your book, The Man Not. So, Dr. Curry, I invited you on tonight because one of our media partners, and let me just say this. I have respect for these women. I have love for these women. They are media partners. I don't have to name their names. They know who they are. And those who listen to the programming on Black Talk Radio Network may have heard that episode, but they did an episode on the sexual harassment, which has been sexual harassment, assault, and rape that has been dominating the headlines. And so I don't know, maybe I was intruding a bit. Maybe I was like, you know, putting my own needs ahead of these women and what have you. But I'm telling you, I'm just so tired of not the conversation, but what's being left out the conversation. And that is the victimization of black males. And so, you know, it just kind of pained me to hear some of my sisters deny that a woman can even perpetrate such a crime against a man. And so I was like, you know, I had to call Dr. Curry and see if he can come on the program and help us delve into this issue, because I feel like that it's being framed this way because it's a political agenda and not so much an agenda to address the issue that is at the core of this national conversation, and that those who have the agenda, it benefits their agenda to focus on male patriarchy, as they say. And let's ignore all these teachers that's molesting these high school boys and younger. Let's ignore the sexual harassment that men have to deal with on the job. Let's not even bring that up, because they can't be victims of this horrible crime. And, you know, nothing could be further from the truth. But before we get into that conversation, Brother Curry, do you have any upcoming events you would like to let our audience know? Any kind of book events, you know, where you're talking about your book and perhaps signing it for folks. Do you got any lectures coming up that you would like to make our listening audience aware of so they can support you?
Oh, well, yes. The next lecture that I'm doing is actually overseas, of Vrije University in Amsterdam, and I'm doing an event for NINSI, the National Institute on the National Legacy of Slavery and Dutch Societies, in December. In the spring, however, I'll be traveling all across the East Coast, and I'll be sure to keep you posted on, you know, which city I'm in the respective months and weeks. But yeah, I mean, I'll be doing a few different book signings, a few lectures at different universities, and I'll try to let the audience know where I'm at. Hopefully some people that are interested can come out and support the work or listen.
Now, we are talking about the Man Knot, right?
Absolutely, absolutely.
And I want to thank you, you know, for this book. Because, I mean, just this past year, it's probably been going on longer than that, but I've been feeling like I'm under assault as a black male. And, you know, and it's particularly pains me because it's coming from my sisters, you know, people that look like my mother, that look like my sister, that look like my daughters. And it just seems that, you know, I'm everything that's what's wrong in my community, and I got a problem, you know, with that, and how quickly people have forgotten that, you know, black males are the ones walking around with that big bullseye on their backs in terms of modern day slavery, as others call it, mass incarceration. I call it slavery, because slavery was never abolished according to the 13th Amendment. So, you know, what do you make of all of this? Is there a political agenda, or is this just sisters, you know, venting?
Well, look, you know, as you know, I'm one of the people that try to do everything based on evidence and assess how individuals' experiences and victimization fit into that. So when we see these stories come about, I don't think that it's incompatible or unbelievable that lots of black women have experienced sexual harassment and sexual assault the way they say. I think that is very possible. I think, however, what's being lost here is the framing of that as a kind of unidirectional violence where men come out as only being perpetrators. And when you do that, when you use experience to give credence to a certain level of causality, in this case, male patriarchy or hypermasculinity, as I've seen on a lot of different blogs, You end up demonizing and criminalizing a population without understanding the sociological factors or the motivations behind it. So again, while I don't think anyone can deny the experiences that women have to sexual violence and sexual harassment and sexual assault, I think what's at contention now, given the national debate, is whether or not black men exist solely as perpetrators. And I think there's a plethora of evidence that shows that that's not the case. Black men have also been victims of sexual assault, rape, and violence. And those are the types of things that are usually ignored when we have these conversations. Take, for example, the findings of Avesta and Cardinier back in the 1950s. These sociologists suggested through their ethnographies, their observations and interviews in black communities, that they discovered that black boys at that period of time lost their virginities between the ages of 7 and 9 to much older adolescent girls. When you look at the national age of sexual debut in this country, black boys usually lose their virginity before the ages of 15. Brianna French and some of her colleagues just came out with an article looking at sexual coercion and prevalence amongst racialized boys that found that black boys, compared to other groups, experience higher levels of sexual coercion, manipulation, and statutory rape. Now, the reason that this is important isn't to go tit for tat right, in terms of why black men may be victims as well. We have to acknowledge that there are male victims of sexual assault and rape. But it's also a question of how you socialize black men. And I think that that's the piece that's being left out. You can't say that you're against rape culture when the effects of rape culture that affect black men and boys are completely ignored. Said differently, if you saw the story of with Peter Guns, you know, that recently came out, where he's breaking down crying, saying, "Look, you know, I was molested by an older woman when I was a young boy. And when I turned 15, because this happened to me, I pressured women into sex. Right. The literature is clear that victims of sexual coercion and early sexual experiences, men who are victims of this type of sexual violence, are more likely to be promiscuous, are more likely to have a child before the age of 21, are more likely to, suffer from anxiety, depression, and various interpersonal conflicts in relationships. So if you're going to put the cause of different kinds of views of women or different treatments of women simply on the idea of patriarchy, which is just vague and ambiguous, and you're going to ignore the specific challenges and traumas that lots of young black males face, in terms of early sexual experiences and sexual coercion, then you're giving a dishonest account of what's happening in our communities. So again, this is not to say that black women don't experience sexual harassment or don't experience rape, or even statutory rape, because their age of sexual abuse is usually before the ages of 18, usually around 17. It means that you're not really being accurate about some of the traumas that's underlining it. You can't expect individuals to somehow buy into a politics that says sexual violence is bad, except when sexual violence happens to males. And I think that's the contradiction that's going on right now. There does need to be a national conversation about female victimization and the violence that happens to black women especially. But there also needs to be a conversation simultaneously about how black men are both perpetrators and victims of the very same kind of violence. And I think that's what the resistance is towards. And I find it ironic because when you look at things like Say Her Name, nobody says you're deflecting when you're introducing the conversation of, well, women get shot by cops too. But somehow when you start introducing conversations about young black men being victims of rape or sexual assault, somehow that's a deflection. You're taking attention away from the real issues. If we're not going to deal, and this is to use an intersectional mantra, if we're not going to deal with all oppressions simultaneously, then we can't, deal with any. But somehow that doesn't apply when we're talking about young black males. And when you look at the sexual oppression of young black males, when you look at their victimization, this often comes from people that they're supposed to trust. This is not from strangers. This is happening to, from mother's friends. This is happening because of babysitters. It's happening because of older classmates or older women that they're left with, that they trust as caretakers. So this creates a huge psychological burden and problem that needs to be discussed on a national stage. I think the way that we encounter black men and boys is that they're always violent, they're always hypersexual, so there's nothing that stops them from pursuing a woman even when they're at the ages of 9 or 10. Mm-hmm. And that's a mistake. That's how we've imposed certain stereotypes on the black men and boys that they don't really deserve. That's part of the racist narrative of the world, that they can't be victims because they always want sex. And I'll be quite honest with you, even as a professor who does this work and presents these types of findings at conferences, I've been told flat out that there's no point of having conversations of black boys being raped because women can't rape black men. They always want sex. And the question isn't whether or not black men want sex. Overwhelmingly, studies show that men think about sex constantly. But the question is, do they just want sex with anyone? Are black men so savage, so hypersexualized, that they can't make choices about who they want to have sex with, that they can't decide who they actually desire? These are some of the problems with this account. And when you look at that and say that these are young boys, and that's what's always been so startling to me. Most of the research I do are on young black boys who have been victims of sexual coercion, usually between the ages of 9 to 15 or 16. People don't show any compassion to them. They're like, well, these boys wanted sex anyway. So what we've done is we've given a certain kind of legitimacy to the stereotypes that affect young black men and boys, and we've held them as truth. We've introduced them as a kind of psychologism where black boys are just going to chase any woman or harass any woman just to get sex, that they don't actually have preferences or desires or a specificity to what they want. And this has led us into this conversation that if a black man is accused of sexual harassment, or if a black man victimizes a black woman, it's because he wanted to dominate her. It's not because of any cultural context that rape culture has been legitimized to a certain extent upon him, or a certain context where there seems to be no contradiction. No matter how many older women have slept with him or sexually approached him, somehow he bears the responsibility of all rape culture by saying no to an underage woman or saying no to a woman who he may be out drinking with and partying with, and they're both intoxicated. These are bourgeois ideas. These are not how things work in our actual communities. This is not how they've worked in our communities for at least, we have evidence for at least more than half a century. So we need to be very careful about what we're saying and what we're suggesting, especially with the idea that men cannot be victims of rape.
I certainly agree. And I just have a problem with this issue being genderized. I don't know if that's a real word or if I just made it up. But when we paint this issue of sexual assault, sexual violence, rape, harassment as a gender-specific issue with one gender being the victim and the other gender being the perpetrator, that just does not seem like a holistic approach to solving the problem. Now, one of the things that you mentioned that kind of made me think about something I read earlier today, you mentioned that 1950 study, and I would say if somebody was to do the same study today, that they have probably come up with the same results of these older adolescent girls, teenagers or whatnot, having sex with pre-adolescent boys. Now, here I read a story today that said a study has shown that if a child, particularly a male child, is spanked, we're talking about corporal punishment, that that child will more than likely grow up to incorporate violence in its in his relationships as he gets older, whether that's domestic violence, partner violence, that has a long-lasting impact on them. Now, in preparation last week for tonight's program, and I wasn't even going to bring it up, but I was just going to leave it to the side, but I found another study that showed that women who molest young boys are found often to have been victims of molestation themselves. So I'm saying if they're saying that women who molest young boys are doing this in part because they were molested themselves, then how true is that on the flip side of it?
Yeah, look, again, this is what I'm saying. You know, one of the reasons that I have so many conflicts with gender theorists and feminists in the academy is because their views of male perpetration are biocentric and cultural. So, the study, what you're saying is completely true. We find the same thing in sexually abused and are even physically abused women, that usually they withdraw. There's high levels of depression or promiscuity or a child before the age of 21, right? These things happen. This is what happens if you abuse a young person, if there is sexual or physical abuse to a young child. But those statistics, those studies show the same thing in men, just in general, in a general rate, or, you know, and those things are never brought into the conversation because the way that we read men is through a kind of Duluthian / Brown Miller's model that says that it's not trauma that inspires men to commit physical acts of aggression or sexual violence. It's patriarchy. And this is, the literature is very clearly defined that it's the clinicians and epidemiologists that are making the arguments about the trauma that men experience and why it leads to these types of behaviors versus a lot of the gender theories that say this is just how men are. So, I mean, I'll give you a great example. A lot of the focus on college rape and rape culture in college, you know, has been very popular over the last, you know, several years. But when the Department of Justice did a special report about rape and sexual assault victimization among college-age females, it found that, you know, from 1995 to 2013, that you did have an average of college rape that was over 10,000. But what the study also found was that male victims of college rape were around 6,700 or 7,000. And, you know, I've been consistently asking people, right, what is it, right? What is it that allows us to just forget that this exists, right? What is it that allows us just to, you know, erase the facts of the matter about male victims? And that's what nobody seems to be able to give me an answer, right? And that's what's so frustrating is that when you talk about these issues, there is an aspect where men suffer too, But anytime you bring up this issue of male trauma or a motivation to sexual assault, people simply look the other way and say that's not something we want to talk about. For example, there's a lawyer / social scientist named Laura Stemple, and her work caused a lot of waves a few years ago because she argued that the rates of sexual violence and sexual victimization amongst men and women in the United States were actually equal. Right, so she actually goes through, you know, BGS statistics and FBI statistics, and you know, and kind of readjusts for the change in the Uniform Crime Record, the UCR, and finds that, you know, basically non-consensual sex over a 12-month period was 1.27 million for men and for women, and nobody talked about this. Right, mm-hmm. She did another article where she talked about female perpetration, and she found that female perpetration by women of sexual assault and violence is pretty much the same, right? So there's a part of the conversation that we're not having, and there's a way in which by denying that males are victims, it paints women as if not only that they're always victims, but they would never commit certain kinds of acts and behaviors. So what that does is it gives a kind of psychology or a moralization to the idea that, well, look, women only are victims of the violence. They never perform violence. And we know that's just not true. Most of the work I do is actually in issues of domestic abuse in the Black community, and we have the same kind of stereotypes, right? That even though you have all this evidence of bidirectionality where Black women are abusing men and men are abusing women because these are communal violence problems, right? Mm-hmm. These are issues of family violence and cycles of violence. People have a very hard time believing that women, you know, hit men or beat men, or that this is related to some kind of psychological or pre-traumatic event. But all the clinical evidence shows this, right? You have an ideological component which says men abuse for power, but that model's been disproved and even disowned by one of the founders, Ellen Pence herself. And even though that model was never formulated on the Black community, because if you go back to the 1930s, you find out that Black women were killing Black men and Black men were killing Black women because they thought Black people were naturally more jealous than white people, and that led to more violence and intimate partner homicide. You know, then you get this moment where in the 1980s where feminists say, oh, it's because of power, and then Black men get thrown into that interpretation. So Black men are killing Black women disproportionately because they want power and they're more hyper-masculine. And then when you go in to study Black neighborhoods, you're like, no, that's not the case. It's still the same thing as the 1930s because Black people are poor. They've had previous trauma. They have, you know, anger, frustration, anxiety, depression, substance abuse, you name it. This is going on in our communities and it causes conflict, right? So if we're going to start having conversations, those conversations have to be specific to the certain kind of causes and the certain kind of motivations that are actually present in our community. We can't keep taking the mainstream European or white view of psychology and gender theory and impose that on Black people, because it's this very simple question. If you take a young boy's virginity, so think about the cases, like I say, Peter Guns, Lil Wayne, Chris Brown, Ray J, right? If look at what these people are saying. I mean, look, Bow Wow came up and was like, you know, I think he said he was 12 when he was raped, right? You know, or when he had his first sexual experience, which is statutory rape. You know, look at how people judge them as perpetrators. Same thing with R. Kelly, right? You know, people say, well, look, R. Kelly has a history of sexual violence. Absolutely. And R. Kelly should be held responsible for those kinds of acts of violence that he's doing to young girls. But part of that responsibility is us acknowledging him as a victim, right? Part of that responsibility is saying that he is telling you that he is a victim of sexual assault, and you're not arguing, you're arguing for criminalization. You're not arguing for mental health treatment or rehabilitation. And that's the problem I have with the conversations. I'm not justifying it because I know, you know, just looking at the data, how harmful sexual assault is for both men and for women. But if we just keep having these Facebook conversations and blog conversations where we're not getting people that are doing psychology or social work or mental health treatment and rehabilitation in on the conversation, then we're just playing the criminalization game. Let's criminalize all men, especially Black men, because they're hyper-masculine, and let's pretend that in these communities, these Black women are just angels. That is not how the world works. And then we shut down conversations when men try to say, yeah, but it's happened to me as well, right? This is a moment where I can contribute to the conversation because I have this violence, and they say, no, you're only the perpetrator, right?
Right.
That's a problem to me.
Right.
And because I don't think that one has to trade off with the other. It doesn't in any other context. So what, I mean, hell, start another, I know everything's done by hashtags. Let's just start another hashtag then. But there needs to be attention on some of these motivations, traumas, and why this violence is happening to Black people in our communities, male and female.
And see, this is what leads me to believe that the conversation, the national conversation thus far, is all about women using this to accumulate power for themselves and not really addressing the issue in regards to, let's find out what's the underlying issue of rape, sexual assault, without genderizing it. And let's address these underlying issues that's affecting our boys and our girls, who then grow up to then possibly become perpetrators. And how do we break this cycle of violence? So I'm led to believe that there is a political agenda underfoot, Dr. Curry, and not so much as they want to solve the problem.
Well, I think that's partially correct. I mean, we've seen time and time again the way that criminalization of sex, especially against white women, has been used to enforce very narrow and specific racial policies.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not like you're just fishing here. I mean, there's a history of that happening over and over again, especially with anti-miscegenation laws, you know, Jim Crow laws, et cetera. I mean, that's the history of that time period. What I would say is I think that the conversation neglects black women. I think that because it focuses on the spaces that white women are in,
right,
you don't get much of an attention to the types of sexual assault that are affecting black women.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's a problem. But again, because you're not focusing on the specificity, the social cultural location of black female victims, that's what makes it easier to neglect the conversations of black men. So, for example, you know, if you're going to talk about, you know, and there was a study that was like from the Black Woman's Blueprint about this a few years ago. And they did a study, and they interviewed, I think, 300 women or maybe 280 women, and they said, oh, well, 80% of the women we interviewed were victims of sexual violence and sexual assault. And everybody was freaking out about this. And I basically said, well, congratulations, you rediscovered the wheel. I was like, your data basically confirms what all the previous data on sexual abuse says, which is that black women lose their virginities before the ages of 18. So, yes, by technical definition, if 18 is the age of consent, then, yes, they are victims of statutory rape, right? But if you look at it within the cultural context, you would say, well, for the last 50 years, black women have lost their virginities before white women. So you're just stating a fact that happens in black culture. And again, you're leaving out the part that black boys also lose their virginities well before the ages of 18. So the way it's the way that we're framing the conversation, right? Like, how are we framing conversations about sexual assault and statutory rape and early sexual abuse in our community? In terms of sexual harassment, again, how are we framing that conversation? If we're going, you know, the holler back video, right, where you see black men saying hello or good morning, you're saying that's sexual harassment or street harassment, you're going to have a hard time, because those are certain norms within working class cultural, you know, communities, right? But if you're talking about, well, you know, here are these women who are being harassed, you know, in workplace, here are they being, you know, assaulted, how they're being, you know, abused and traumatized, then that's a different conversation, because that conversation allows us to take advantage of things like Title IX and, you know, different EEOC. It allows us to hear, you know, stories that actually demand that the changes that they're saying are the problems that they're saying are happening need to address, have be changed, right? And we should respond to that. I think that the black community should listen to that and learn. However, when black men say, well, look, when I'm in the workplace, I feel as if I can be touched. I feel that I can be assaulted. I feel, you know, not just by other men, but also by women, we also need to pay attention to that. Because when you look at, you know, the actual data from the EEOC, you find that every year there's a rising increase of sexual assault cases in the workplace. So it's amazing to me actual fact.
I'm sorry. Yes. Are you saying that in the EEOC that there is a rise in complaints initiated by men against women perpetrators? I wasn't clear on what you were saying.
Yeah. There's this article that Brenda Russell did with a colleague, where she actually talks about sexual harassment of female to male, right? And one of the things she reports there is that, you know, since 2000, you know, you've seen an increase in men's claims of sexual harassment. Right. So, you know, from like the late 1990s, I think she says like 97 or 98 to 2011 or 2012, you can see a constant increase in men complaining about sexual harassment in the workforce. Right.
Mm-hmm.
And again, this is not a claim to replace or to refute, but it's saying that, look, you know, if you have about 50% of men who are in workplace environments saying that they've been victims of sexual harassment or unwanted sexual advances, and you just say, well, that's not important because it's men, then I think you're missing the point, right? Because you're missing the cultural context by which people exercise power, or people suggest that they, since they can't be perpetrators, that they can never be held liable. So that gives women and other kinds of men a certain type of power. Then we're not really doing our jobs in terms of studying the causes and motivations behind this kind of harassment and violence. So context is everything. Specificity and nuance is everything. But you don't have a lot of people that study things from the men's side, because when you have conversations about men, it's usually perceived as reactionary and against women. And that's a big problem when you're talking about black men, because black men disproportionately experience sexual harassment, coercion, et cetera, more than other groups of men. And if you can't have that conversation because they're saying that it's reactionary, then you're not going to get to the underlying motivation. I mean, we find the exact same thing when you look at intimate partner violence. You know, lots of people say, well, if men would just give up patriarchy, then there wouldn't be intimate partner violence. But overwhelmingly, when you look at men who have been taken outside of the homes, you have other cycles of violence. And you have violence that's initiated by women that are conducted and perpetrated on other partners after the initial experience of violence, right? Mm. So you can take the male abuser outside the home, and there's still all kind of effects and behaviors that happen, because a lot of times it's the women. And you're not ever addressing women's harassment or women's hitting or women's emotional abuse, so you just create the same cycles of violence. And if children witness that cycle of violence or see violence, all the studies, you know, this is Carolyn West, she reports that, you know, children who even see one act of interpersonal violence or domestic violence are more likely to become abusers themselves, right? So you can't break a cycle by just blaming one party.
Right.
And I think that that's what happens, because remember, and I say this again, and I try to emphasize this to all the listeners, none of these theories were done by studies, by looking at what's happening to black people in their own communities. These are studies that were done with very narrow, you know, surveys and interviews with white women and white male perpetrators and maybe some Native American men. Okay. And they created a general theory that had no clinical backing, because, you know, there's a long explanation why Pence manipulated some of the interviews. So this is, that was a political moment, right? That was a way that they were trying to get political credence. It has nothing to do with what actually causes sexual violence and domestic abuse within black and brown communities. So when we have these conversations and try to frame them within these ways, we're criminalizing one group of people without looking at the various traumas that are happening on both sides and the structural and cultural things that, that increase and cause these problems.
Well,
you know, one of the things that I'm always trying to tell people is we have to focus on treatment, right?
Right.
If you're concerned by the age of sexual debut and statutory rape in our communities, then let's talk about treatment and education. Let's talk about, you know, because I mean, think about it. Because if black boys are losing their virginity before the ages of 15, then this means that we need to start sexual education with this group well before around 9 or 10.
And we might also want to look at their environment, because, I mean, we could say this in general terms about American media and how it just is so sexually saturated, and then certain types of music. So I would say, you know, the environment plays into it's just so many variables that you have an incomplete diagnosis if you don't include all the different variables.
And right now, you're absolutely right. And instead of us looking at the different variables that causes sexual violence, we're basing it strictly on racial stereotypes, right?
And gender stereotypes.
We're interpreting young black boys as super predators and rapists.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I find to be morally deplorable about some of these conversations. The issue, and again, you know, and I've seen some of the reactions, right, on social media where black men have reacted as like, you know, well, I deny this experience, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And I think that's the wrong way to go, because, you know, we should believe victims. But notice, when I say we should believe victims, that means we should believe female victims and we should believe male victims. You can't pick and choose.
Right.
Because like I said, you can be both. You know, I did this, you know, in my class. You know, I was telling one of my colleagues a while back, when I first started studying the rape of black men and boys, I got really, you know, I would say it was a small form of depression. Because what happened was I start studying the rape of black men and boys throughout slavery, right? Okay. And I would give presentations about black men being victims of rape and homoeroticism, et cetera, because, you know, I deal with intellectual history, and, you know, something kept telling me that, you know, black men are victims of rape. And when I would give these presentations, I would have, and I'm not, you know, inflated here. At every conference that I would give a presentation, I had at least one or two black men come to me and tell me that they were also victims of rape.
Wow.
And at first, I thought, when I first started doing it, I thought, oh, it was just a coincidence, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, general population. I was like, hey, you know, you control for it. You know, I think it says something like 1 in 6, 1 in 7 men victims of rape. You know, just thinking like this is well within the normal rate. But it happened at every conference, every conference. And then I remember one time I was heading to a conference, and I think I actually posted about this on my Facebook page. A white man came to me. He saw my books and everything, and he said, you know, what do you do? What do you study? And I told him. And he sat down and talked to me for about 15 or 20 minutes about how he was raped as a young boy. So these experiences that men have are something that they hold within them. And he told me, he's like, I've never spoken to anyone about this except for until now. And a lot of the black boys that I talk to, the black men that I speak to at conferences, will say the same thing, that I've never spoken about this until now. And, you know, when I was teaching my graduate course in black male studies, I had a student tell the class about how he was raped as a 9-year-old boy, that he was, you know, just learning how to swim. And these two girls, he said that one was, I think, 14 and the other was 12, brought him into the deep end of the water. And he said he remembered how scared he was, that he thought he was going to drown because he just learned how to swim. And they were confident about, oh, you'll be fine. And they put him on a wall, and then they performed oral sex on him. And he was so frightened that for years he just never wanted to be alone with a woman because he associated that sexual experience with the fear of drowning.
Wow.
And there is no way to talk about that, right? And he told me this. He told me this once before, you know, when I was doing an interview with him, and then he told the class the same story. And that story sticks with me out of all the stories I've heard, you know, in doing this kind of work, because I don't know what to tell him, because I'm not a clinician.
Okay.
And for years I've heard these stories and I've never known what to say. So what I do now is I record them, I report them, I look at the literature, I try to form theories about why this happens to black men and boys. But, you know, the most heartbreaking thing that I personally see in these conversations is that when black men say this happens to me, there's an immediate shutdown of the conversation. Like,
right.
No, you don't own your own experience, or no, you're a liar. And I can tell you, I can tell your audience, I can tell the people who are open, who are at least open-minded enough to listen to this, these men are not lying. Because when you see their body language and when you see the tears in their eyes, it is exactly like what Peter Gunn said. That's what made me believe him. Because you see them struggling to confess what has happened to them. You see them struggling to try it's a moment where they want to tell you what happened, but then it's like, well, would this person that I'm telling believe me? And I think that it's so hard for black men because we live in a world where nobody believes that we suffer pain, or nobody believes that we have trauma, or they just think that we're violent. So,
or that we want this
for these men to talk about.
Or we want this. I think, you know,
right,
that this society, I can't speak outside of this society, but from what I see is that men, especially black men, have to repress a lot of this stuff that is happening to them, not only because of what you said, well, will anybody believe me, but also, will I be mocked? Will I be ridiculed? Oh,
right.
You know you wanted it, you know.
Exactly.
And then, you know, I hate it when I see, and I don't know if these are men or not, I just see, you know, male names associated with comments on social media or on these articles and stuff. But I keep seeing, Dr. Tommy, article after article after article of all these arrests of primarily white teachers, white female teachers who are preying on these young boys. And so, you know, I see these other guys commenting saying, oh, I wish I had that teacher. And, you know, and it's treated as a joke.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that is why a lot of males won't come forward with this. But I want men, primarily black men, to start talking about this trauma that has happened to us. Now, earlier, you know, we was talking about sexual harassment on a job, and you had mentioned that a study was done that since the 90s, I believe you said, that there has been an increase of males reporting sexual harassment on a job. And when I when I first had the idea for this program, what made me want to do the program is, number one, I felt like the sexual harassment that I shared on air was minimized when I was sexually harassed at 18 years old by my 30-something-year-old white female manager, actually grabbing a handful of my behind and what have you. And, you know, I just started counting. And I can count at least 5 instances where I was sexually harassed or pressured on the job. And I never reported it. And I'm saying to myself, I can understand how these women feel that's talking about this issue, because I didn't feel comfortable with that woman putting her hands on me, and then her being married, and then her husband always coming to the job like he knows she cheating, and then I'm like, you know, this...
I understand.
Hey, it's crazy.
Yeah,
it was very stressful. And then that whole climate, as, you know, all the managers were white females, and then I'm hearing them. I guess you would say in today's language that they use is that I was working with a bunch of cougars. And, you know, just that whole atmosphere, sexualized atmosphere, I was like, man, I did not know women talk like this. I really didn't, because I had no exposure to it beforehand. But, I, you know, even as I... when I went into the Army, I had a lieutenant who tried to pressure me into having sex with her. And, you know, that's, she's my lieutenant. You know, that's a no-no, no fraternization and all of this. But then at the same time, this is a woman who can get me promoted faster and get extra money in my pocket. And so when she cornered me in this trailer and made it known to me what she wanted, just how stressful that was, as I'm debating in my mind, I'm like, I don't want to be with this woman, but she's my lieutenant and I don't know what to do. And my reaction to that was just to talk shop, you know, just to talk business. But that was a traumatic experience for me as a young man. And I feel like that, as you have stated to us here tonight, that we aren't being taken serious, and that, you know, this is just, we're like invisible.
No. Well, yeah, I mean, look, I think, and I'll be very honest with you. I remember when I was younger, you know, a lot of people know this. I came up through debate. That's how I paid for college. Sexual comments were constantly made, you know, by white women about me. You know, questions about how well they thought I could have sex or what my penis looked like, things of this sort. So, you know, I think lots of black men, because of the way that racism and hypersexuality work, have experienced that in professional settings. But at the same time, you know, I mean, I started college when I was 17. So, you know, I was younger than everybody else. I didn't know how to deal with the situation. I just pretended it didn't exist. I kept my head down because I knew being from the South, that, you know, if a white woman says something about you, more likely than not, people are going to believe her and not you.
Right.
You know, and I think that that's what happens to a lot of black men in these situations, is that, you know, lots of people, I'll just tell you this real quick. Lots of people have an issue with the fact that myself and scholars like William A. Smith use the ideas of racist misandry or anti-black misandry because they think that misandry is a made-up myth. But when you look at black men, that's not the case. With black men, there is a long documented history from the 19th century of the hatred towards black men specifically, as rapists, as vermin, as criminals, as deviants, as X, Y, and Z, right? So you know, it's like when you, if you trace the history of misogyny and say, oh, well, people have always hated women because of sexism and think of their inferior sex, X, Y, and Z. And you look in these very same time periods, you see, oh, but they also hated racialized men because they thought that they were diseased and that they were going to take their women and they were going to rape their children, right? Because back in the 18 and 1900s, they thought that, you know, part of the deviance of black male sexual and racial inferiority was that they were homosexuals too, right? So all that's thrown specifically on black men. And nobody wants to believe that these things have carried forward to the 21st century despite the evidence. So when you look at how black men react to their own victimization, when you look at how black men are not believed, when you look at the, like we're talking now, like we both were like, these types of things happen. I mean, I had a white woman get drunk and told me that she would like to look at my big black dick before, right? Like these things happen. There's no conversation of it. Because when you say it, people are like, well, I don't believe Mark. Come on, you know you really wanted it. Mm-hmm. So black men live in this world where they cut themselves off from other people because they know if they say anything about their experiences, they're most likely going to be viewed as perpetrators and not victims. And I think that that's a very bad psychological place to be. And listen, you know, I'm a full professor. If anybody should be believed, it should be me, right? You know, married with two daughters, like, I'm a victim. But that's not how the world works. So I, like I said, I think that in some of the reactions we see from black men, it's them trying to reconcile this kind of acknowledgement of victimization on the one hand by white women and black women and women in general, where, you know, even though it's empirically shown that they suffer the same kind of victimizations, and sometimes, like in the case of statutory rape, far earlier, people just won't believe them. They won't give them any attention or recognition to these facts.
Or they don't think it's harmful, Dr. Curry. They don't think that that's a harmful experience for adolescent black male, you know. And
right.
And you know, we are getting close to the end here, but I wanted to make you aware of a lawsuit. And again, all of this talk about rape, sexual assault, sexual harassment, it needs to happen. It needs, because people are being victimized, but it needs to be talked about in an inclusive way and not trying to pit gender against gender. Okay.
I agree.
The underlying
issue. We have
issues.
To have a conversation.
But
I'm sorry to interrupt you.
That's okay, Dr. Curry. I shared a story a couple of weeks ago, and I'm saying all of this news media attention is on sexual assault, rape, and sexual violence. 900 teen boys in the state of Michigan just filed a class, well, they didn't just file it, but it's just now making its way to the appeals court. But they filed a class action lawsuit because they had been raped in prison. And not just by other men, but by female guards as well. And nobody's taking this serious. I'm not seeing it public. CNN ain't doing a story on it. MSNBC. Now, I can put part of that on, well, they ain't never cared about slaves. You know, why should they care about prison slaves and whatnot? They not interested in that. They interested in supporting mass incarceration, not trying to examine, you know, this victimization that's occurring on these plantations. And so when I introduced that story to people, well, I had to say the people that's connected to me and my social circles, they did treat the story with the appropriate empathy.
Right.
But the wider so-called, you know, social media community, it's like these 900 black boys' lives don't matter.
Right. Well, look, this is one of the strengths of Laura Stepple's work, right? Because what she does in her study, she shows that we don't look at prison rape as one of the ways that men suffer rape. And we don't really consider the way that the criminal justice, especially juvenile courts, our juvenile detention facilities, also have high numbers of incidents of rape that disproportionately affect black and brown boys. So there are people, you know, in the beginning of my book, I talk about this, right? Because what I try to do in the introduction is I try to readjust the way that we're interacting with the victimization of black men. I'm trying to show that black men do suffer from lower rates of graduation as well as higher rates of sexual assault. And some of this does happen in the prison industrial complex, in detention centers, and in prisons. And the perpetrators are not just men. It's female staff. Overwhelmingly, there was actually a study done not too long ago, and I quote this in my introduction, where I talk about the reports of rape in jail. Over half of them say that it was a female staff member, right? That was exercising power over them as men. And that's a huge finding. But even when this study came out, nobody picked it up, right? So there's that, again, that's the problem. The problem is that, you know, even when you talk about criminalization of black men, that criminalization puts them in environments and spaces where they can be sexually assaulted and raped. And, you know, and I got to be honest with you. You know, I've seen contexts of situations where people laugh at that. Like, oh, you're going to prison, so you're going to be raped.
Yes.
Guard your booty. Don't drop the soap.
Right.
So then, and you know, and that's why I ask these people. So okay, so if you're laughing about men being raped by other men or being raped by, you know, prison staff, guards, and officers, then what kind of man do you think is going to come out?
Exactly.
Like, you see, this is what I'm saying about the dehumanization. You say black men are violent, but then you laugh about the violence that happens to them. And then you act like the violence that happens to them doesn't affect how they perceive violence towards others. Like, if you're in a society that says you can rape men when you please, or women can rape little boys when they're 7, 8, 9 years old, or 13 or 14 years old, if you know that that's the case, how do those people, how do they process rape culture?
Mm.
Because the view is, well, you can rape me. So then what is the moral compass that you expect these victims to have? Because when women, and this is what I'm always saying, when women are victims of abuse, if a woman cuts off her husband's penis or kills her abusive spouse, people are like, well, I understood. But then we can't believe that men are in situations, especially black men are in situations, where they've been sexually victimized, physically assaulted, threatened by the women in their lives. That's not true. I mean, this is one of the reasons that I'm a big supporter of Stacey Patton's work on child abuse, because it shows that the prevalence of child abuse in black communities does affect the way that black men are socialized.
Right.
That you got to look at some of the trauma that black men experience at the hands of their mothers and aunts and et cetera, et cetera. And that could be physical, it could be sexual. So if you're taking that out the picture and you're just starting with, well, black men are misogynistic and sexist, then you're scapegoating. Because black men don't naturally grow up to hate black women. Is that in poor communities overwhelmingly, because this is where domestic abuse and sexual violence happens, black men are having these kinds of experiences, and it's socializing within a cycle of physical and sexual violence and trauma. And until we start recognizing black males as victims and not solely as perpetrators, none of these problems that we're talking about are going to be solved.
It's
just going to be an endless cycle. And I think that that's the thing that black men, you know, and I understand why black men are angry about it, right? Like I said, I understand the reactions that black men are having, because they're saying, you know, both, I didn't do anything, right, and I'm a victim, and none of that matters. So all you're telling me is that I'm to blame. So I understand the anger and frustration. But you know, I would say that we have to pull back a little.
Okay.
We have to listen to what our sisters are telling us, because again, that's part of the cycle too.
Right.
That women are being abused, and that creates trauma for them.
Right.
But at the same time, we have to insist that our stories are inserted. Right.
Right.
Not at the expense of what black women are going through, but to say, listen, I understand, but you have to listen to me about this. That this experience complements what you're saying, because if we're serious about improving ourselves and our communities, you have to deal with both sides of it. You can't just say that we're perpetrators when we have overwhelming evidence to show that we're also victims.
Right. And that is a conversation, unfortunately, that isn't being had, but I hope with this program and more follow-up that we'll be able to push this into the conversation again. I am not interested in some kind of gender war. I'm interested
right.
in solving the problem. And there are many variables to this problem. And if we want a correct solution, we can't leave variables out. And it doesn't do anyone's community any justice if we're only seeking to create a gender war and scapegoat certain genders. We do have a call. We got about 7 minutes left in this broadcast.
Yes,
we got a call. Are you up for taking calls, Dr. Curry?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
Okay. Area code 646. Thank you for tuning in and calling in to BTR News. Dr. Tommy J. Curry is our guest tonight. Do you have a question or a comment for us?
Yes, peace, Brother Scotty, and peace, Dr. Curry. My question, very quickly, and before I present the question, I just want to say that I greatly appreciate, you know, yet again, the fact that the BTR network and Black Talk Radio News is, you know, propelling a development that's really going completely unaddressed out here in the general, you know, approaches as regards these various channels, particularly, you know, the fact that, you know, many of these issues have been discussed as far as like the reasons why this goes unaddressed. But I just wanted to ask, in your view, Dr. Curry, is there some means of us presenting the reality of a black male non-predatory reality out here, you know, whether that be, you know, spatially and physically, or, you know, speech pattern wise, et cetera, just in your, based on your observation and in your experience, what does help to support the reality that black males are not 100% of the time or even anywhere near to that predatory beings in the world? You know, what signals have you identified that help to point toward the reality that these representations are not accurate at all?
Well, I think a few things. One is, you know, and I'll be honest with you, one of the reasons that I wanted to create a Black Male Studies and I wrote the book The Man Not is because I felt that there was no other text in existence that did not apologize for black men existing. So the first thing, you know, I'm very much an empiricist. You know, we have to look at the facts, right? And that is not what we're doing when we talk about black men today. We're not looking at the facts of the matter. We read black men through stereotypes. So whether it's statutory rape or sexual coercion or just violence, you know, the whole blow up that I had in my response to Damian Young, you know, these are stereotypes. It's simply not true that the disproportionate rate of domestic abuse in the black community is due to black men's violence. It's never been true. It's a myth. It's been retracted. It's been, you know, withdrawn. Like it doesn't even apply to white people. So, you know, we use bad theories to talk about black men first and foremost. The second thing that I think that prevents us from understanding the humanity of black men is we don't see them as victims. So one of the reasons that I came up with the term black male vulnerability is because you can't analyze perpetration unless you understand that perpetrators can also be victims and that perhaps the cause of what they're doing is related to some previous or antecedent trauma. Every other group gets that. You know, we see it constantly with white people because they're like, oh, the white person had a mental illness, which is why they went out and shot 60 people, right? We see it with black women. Oh, the reason that she's behaving this way, the reason that she's abusive or depressed, et cetera, is because of a previous relationship. But we do it with every other group. We just don't do it for black men. And the effect of that, the effect of not doing it for black men, is that we legitimize conversations which see black men as fundamentally pathological and less than human, right? So I think my hope is that a Black Male Studies will change this. My hope is that when people read The Man Not, it will give them some weapons, so to speak, to fight against these stereotypes. It will help show people that what we need is less criminalization and more discussions about mental health and treatment and therapy and economic and community programs, rather than suggesting that black men are the cause of all criminality, deviance, and negativity in our communities.
Did you have anything else for us, Tag?
No, not necessarily. I know we're up against the time, but I just greatly, again, greatly appreciate the discussion and hear you on that response.
All right. Thank you, Tag, and keep up the great work up there in NYC.
Absolutely, and you as well, and to the BTR community at large.
All right, that was Tag joining us. Dr. Curry, again, like I was stating, I'm not trying to start a gender war. I'm not trying to deflect from what's happening to women. But I'm going to be honest, I am getting angry that my experiences and the experiences of my brothers are being minimized or disregarded totally. And that criminalization that you speak of, it's been around for centuries on this continent. You know, it's been around for centuries. Right. And all it does, and you would think some of our sisters, our more enlightened sisters, would not fall into the trap, because it's been played on us before, you know, with Hillary Clinton, the whole super predator, and all of this is a driving force to do what? Put us right back into slavery, to justify our caging us, because we're beasts. We don't have feelings. We can't be victimized in such a manner. And so I'm just trying to make it a more inclusive conversation. I'm not trying to push anybody out the space or anything like that. I'm just trying to introduce a variable to the conversation.
Well, no, look, again, that's why I say I think black men have to have the courage to insert themselves in these conversations. You know, what I think happened, unlike other people, I don't read conversations of black men from a pathological or malicious place. Because I see the pain. I know these stories exist. I've seen the data. I've interviewed, you know, male victims of rape. So, you know, I don't see it that way. What I'm saying is that we have to be careful, because we don't want to erase other people's narratives or experiences. We also have to be deliberate and diligent in making sure that our experiences are heard too. Right. So, like I said, if there's pushback that people don't want to hear men's experiences, well, that's just too bad. Right. Because men are victims. But that doesn't mean, like I said, I just don't understand why people think these things are contradictory or contradictions. Like, I can both accept that women experience high rates of domestic violence, sexual assault, and rape. And I can accept that men do, too. Like, there's 40 million black people in the country. Like, there's more than enough people to commit both. And so I don't understand the gender calculus or the investment of saying, well, because women are victims, they can't be perpetrators. And I think that's what a lot of the gender theory boils down to. And I know where the thinking comes from. I know it comes from Bowers, Miller, and Duluth. But I don't understand why we're employing that in our conversations as black people. So what I would like to see is, you know, forums. I mean, this doesn't have to be the end of the conversation. This doesn't have to be a conversation that everybody agrees with. But there can be forums. There can be reading groups. You know, I talk about this in The Man Not. You know, we need to get people that are fundamentally interested in addressing this question, platforms and venues and forums to do that, right? Because without that, you know, black men are going to constantly try to rationalize these traumas by themselves, mm-hmm. and they won't be able to figure them out because they're not given the same support system and community to say, yes, I hear you, and you too are a victim.
Thank you again, Dr. Curry, for your work on this area, and I agree with you 100%. We do need a black male studies. I think it'd be very therapeutic for not only the black male, but the black family. And I think that it would go a long way towards healing our community and minimizing these instances of whether we're talking about sexual violence or physical violence. And I think we will find, and you may can confirm this, but just from the studies I've read, that a lot of this is rooted in childhood experiences, and we need to break that cycle.
Absolutely. And that's what I'm saying, you know, especially with black men, because black men are usually victimized as children and young adults / teenagers with sexual violence. Because once they get past puberty and becoming men, you know, there's the physicality issue. You can't overpower them. But as they're younger, right? So, you know, for black men, there's a certain vulnerability to being socialized into sexual violence that we have to pay attention to.
Well, thank you again for joining us, Dr. Curry. And please keep me informed of your East Coast swing when you'll be going on your book tour after you come back from overseas. And we wish you, you know, a successful trip over there to Amsterdam. And we're going to pray that the Creator, you know, keep you in his protect under his protective wing or her. I can hear somebody complaining now, right? All right. But you be safe out there, Dr. Curry, and we definitely want to have you back at a future date.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for the invitation.
All right. That was Dr. Tommy J. Curry. We certainly appreciate his time in speaking on this very important issue that has to deal with our family members. Again, this I'm not looking to start no gender war or even respond to this war against black males. No, what I'm looking at doing is solving problems in our communities. And before you can find out what the problem is, you need to identify all the variables that make up that problem so that then you can employ the proper solution. So I think his work is very, very important. I would say timely, but I would say this is something that should have been addressed a long time ago. So I'm certainly appreciative of his efforts and his sticking his neck out there, you know, and because I'm sure he's getting pushback, you know, for this book and for his work. All right. So we come to the end of the broadcast. Again, I want to thank Sister Sophia for joining us to bring us that information about the events that's going to be occurring in Philly this week starting Friday. You got an event going on Friday and Saturday. The teaching for Mamiya at Black Lives Ever Matter. That's December the 8th. Also, the second event in Philly will be December the 9th. That'll be the march and the rally in support of Mamiya Abu-Jamal, including a forum on mass incarceration, which, of course, y'all know I call the continuation of slavery. All right. Recognize the fact that you live behind the enemy lines of USA Inc., that there is a battlefield out there. There's a war being waged and that slavery was never abolished. You call it policing. I call it slave catching. And when we recognize the threat, the true threat that's out there, perhaps we will take certain precautions, whether that's a change in our behavior, not saying that we're doing anything wrong, but, you know, a change in our behavior that we become more codified so as we could escape the traps that have been laid for us. But with that said, I wish everyone peace and blessings. Y'all be safe out there. This is Scotty Reed, BTR News, signing off.